Chapter 2. The Utopia of Greed. Good morning. She looked at him across the living room from the threshold of her door. In the windows behind him, the mountains had that tinge of silver pink, which seems brighter than daylight, with the promise of a light to come. The sun had risen somewhere over the earth, but it had not reached the top of the barrier, and the sky was glowing in its stead, announcing its motion. She had heard the joyous greeting to the sunrise, which was not the song of birds, but the ringing of the telephone a moment ago. She saw the start of day not in the shining green of the branches outside, but in the glitter of chromium on the stove, the sparkle of a glass ashtray on a table, and the crisp whiteness of his shirt sleeves. Irresistibly she heard the sound of a smile in her own voice, matching his, as she answered, "Good morning." He was gathering notes of penciled calculations from his desk and stuffing them into his pocket. "I have to go down to the powerhouse," he said. "They've just phoned me that they're having trouble with the ray screen. Your plane seems to have knocked it off key. I'll be back in half an hour, and then I'll cook our breakfast." It was the casual simplicity of his voice, the manner of taking her presence and their domestic routine for granted, as if it were of no significance to them, that gave her the sense of an underscored significance and the feeling that he knew it. She answered, as casually, "If you'll bring me the cane I left in the car, I'll have breakfast ready for you by the time you come back." He glanced at her with a slight astonishment. His eyes moved from her bandaged ankle to the short sleeves of the blouse that left her arms bare to display the heavy bandage on her elbow. But the transparent blouse, the open collar, the hair falling down to the shoulders that seemed innocently naked under a thin film of cloth, made her look like a schoolgirl, not an invalid, and her posture made the bandages look irrelevant. He smiled, not quite at her, but as if in amusement at some sudden memory of his own. "If you wish," he said. It was strange to be left alone in his house. Part of it was an emotion she had never experienced before, an awed respect that made her hesitantly conscious of her hands, as if to touch any object around her would be too great an intimacy. The other part was a reckless sense of ease, a sense of being at home in this place, as if she owned its owner. It was strange to feel so pure a joy in the simple task of preparing a breakfast. The work seemed an end in itself, as if the motions of filling a coffee pot, squeezing oranges, slicing bread, were performed for their own sake, for the sort of pleasure one expects but seldom finds in the motions of dancing. It startled her to realize that she had not experienced this kind of pleasure in her work since her days at the operator's desk in Rockdale Station. She was setting the table when she saw the figure of a man hurrying up the path to the house, a swift, agile figure that leaped over boulders with the casual ease of a flight. He threw the door open, calling, "Hey, John!" and stopped short as he saw her. He wore a dark blue sweater and slacks. He had gold hair and a face of such shocking perfection of beauty that she stood still, staring at him, not in admiration at first, but in simple disbelief. He looked at her as if he had not expected to find a woman in this house. Then she saw a look of recognition melting into a different kind of astonishment, part amusement, part triumph, melting into a chuckle. "Oh, have you joined us?" he asked. "No," she answered dryly. "I haven't. I'm a scab." He laughed like an adult at a child who uses technological words beyond its understanding. "If you know what you're saying, you know that it's not possible," he said. "Not here." "I crashed the gate, literally." He looked at her bandages, weighing the question, his glance almost insolent in its open curiosity. "When?" "Yesterday." "How?" "In a plane." "What were you doing in a plane in this part of the country?" He had the direct, imperious manner of an aristocrat or a roughneck. He looked like one and was dressed like the other. She considered him for a moment, deliberately letting him wait. "I was trying to land on a prehistorical mirage," she answered. "And I have." "You are a scab," he said, and chuckled, as if grasping all the implications of the problem. "Where's John?" "Mr. Galt is at the powerhouse. He should be back any moment." He sat down in an armchair, asking no permission, as if he were at home. She turned silently to her work. He sat watching her movements with an open grin, as if the sight of her laying out cutlery on a kitchen table were the spectacle of some special paradox. "What did Francisco say when he saw you here?" he asked. She turned to him with a slight jolt, but answered evenly, "He is not here yet."
"Not yet?"
He seemed startled.
"Are you sure?"
"So I was told." He lighted a cigarette. She wondered, watching him, what profession he had chosen, loved, and abandoned, in order to join this valley. She could make no guess, none seemed to fit. She caught herself in the preposterous feeling of wishing that he had no profession at all, because any work seemed too dangerous for his incredible kind of beauty. It was an impersonal feeling. She did not look at him as at a man, but as at an animated work of art, and it seemed to be a stressed indignity of the outer world that a perfection such as his should be subjected to the shocks, the strains, the scars reserved for any man who loved his work. But the feeling seemed the more preposterous because the lines of his face had the sort of hardness for which no danger on earth was a match.
"No, Miss Taggart," he said suddenly, catching her glance. "You've never seen me before."
She was shocked to realize that she had been studying him openly.
"How do you happen to know who I am?" she asked.
"First, I've seen your pictures in the papers many times. Second, you're the only woman left in the outer world, to the best of our knowledge, who'd be allowed to enter Galt's Gulch. Third, you're the only woman who'd have the courage and prodigality still to remain a scab."
"What made you certain that I was a scab?"
"If you weren't, you'd know that it's not this valley, but the view of life held by men in the outer world that is a prehistorical mirage."
They heard the sound of the motor and saw the car stopping below in front of the house. She noticed the swiftness with which he rose to his feet at the sight of Galt in the car. If it were not for the obvious personal eagerness, it would have looked like an instinctive gesture of military respect. She noticed the way Galt stopped when he entered and saw his visitor. She noticed that Galt smiled, but that his voice was oddly low, almost solemn, as if weighted with unconfessed relief, when he said very quietly,
"Hello."
"Hi, John," said the visitor gaily. She noticed that their handshake came an instant too late and lasted an instant too long, like the handshake of men who had not been certain that their previous meeting would not be their last. Galt turned to her.
"Have you met?" he asked, addressing them both.
"Not exactly," said the visitor.
"Miss Taggart, may I present Ragnar Danneschuld?"
She knew what her face had looked like when she heard Danneschuld's voice, as from a great distance.
"You don't have to be frightened, Miss Taggart. I'm not dangerous to anyone in Galt's Gulch."
She could only shake her head before she recaptured her voice to say, "It's not what you're doing to anyone. It's what they're doing to you." His laughter swept her out of her moment's stupor.
"Be careful, Miss Taggart. If that's how you're beginning to feel, you won't remain a scab for long."
He added,
"But you ought to start by adopting the right things from the people in Galt's Gulch, not their mistakes. They've spent 12 years worrying about me. Needlessly."
He glanced at Galt.
"When did you get in?" asked Galt.
"Late last night."
"Sit down, you're going to have breakfast with us."
"But where's Francisco? Why isn't he here yet?"
"I don't know," said Galt, frowning slightly. "I asked at the airport just now. Nobody's heard from him."
As she turned to the kitchen, Galt moved to follow.
"No," she said. "It's my job today."
"Let me help you."
"This is the place where one doesn't ask for help, isn't it?" He smiled.
"That's right."
She had never experienced the pleasure of motion, of walking as if her feet had no weight to carry, as if the support of the cane in her hand were merely a superfluous touch of elegance, the pleasure of feeling her steps trace swift, straight lines, of sensing the faultless, spontaneous precision of her gestures, as she experienced it while placing their food on the table in front of the two men. Her bearing told them that she knew they were watching her. She held her head like an actress on a stage, like a woman in a ballroom, like the winner of a silent contest.
"Francisco will be glad to know that it's you who were his stand-in today," said Danneschuld, when she joined them at the table.
"His what?"
"You see, today is June 1st, and the three of us, John, Francisco, and I, have had breakfast together on every June 1st for 12 years.
"Here?"
"Not when we started, but here ever since this house was built 8 years ago.
He shrugged, smiling. For a man who has more centuries of tradition behind him than I have, it's odd that Francisco should be the first to break our own tradition.
And Mr. Gault? She asked. How many centuries does he have behind him?
John? None at all. None behind him. But all of those ahead. Never mind the centuries, said Gault. Tell me what sort of year you've had behind you.
Lost any men?
No.
Lost any of your time?
You mean was I wounded? No, I haven't had a scratch since that one time 10 years ago when I was still an amateur, which you ought to forget by now. I wasn't in any danger whatever this year. In fact, I was much more safe than if I were running a small-town drug store under Directive 10-289.
Lost any battles?
No. The losses were all on the other side this year. The looters lost most of their ships to me and most of their men to you. You've had a good year, too, haven't you? I know I've kept track of it. Since our last breakfast together, you got everyone you wanted from the state of Colorado and a few others besides, such as Ken Daniger, who was a great prize to get. But let me tell you about a still greater one who is almost yours. You're going to get him soon because he's hanging by a thin thread and is just about ready to fall at your feet. He's a man who saved my life, so you can see how far he's gone.
Gault leaned back, his eyes narrowing.
So you weren't in any danger whatever, were you?
Donnershuld laughed.
Oh, I took a slight risk. It was worth it. It was the most enjoyable encounter I've ever had. I've been waiting to tell you about it in person. It's a story you'll want to hear.
Do you know who the man was?
No. Hank Reardon.
I know. It was Galt's voice. It was a command. The brief snap of sound had a tinge of violence neither of them had ever heard from him before.
What? Asked Donnershuld softly, incredulously.
Don't tell me about it now.
But you've always said that Hank Reardon was the one man you wanted to see here most.
I still do.
But you'll tell me later.
She studied Galt's face intently, but she could find no clue, only a closed, impersonal look, either of determination or of control, that tightened the skin of his cheekbones and the line of his mouth. No matter what he knew about her, she thought, the only knowledge that could explain this was a knowledge he had had no way of acquiring.
"You've met Hank Reardon?" she asked, turning to Donnershuld.
"And he saved your life?"
"Yes."
"I want to hear about it."
I don't, said Gault.
Why not?
You're not one of us, Miss Taggart.
I see. She smiled with a faint touch of defiance.
Were you thinking that I might prevent you from getting Hank Reardon?
No, that was not what I was thinking. She noticed that Donnershuld was studying Galt's face, as if he too found the incident inexplicable. Gault held his glance, deliberately and openly, as if challenging him to find the explanation, and promising that he would fail. She knew that Donnershuld had failed when she saw a faint crease of humor softening Galt's eyelids.
"What else," asked Gault, "have you accomplished this year?"
"I've defied the law of gravitation."
"You've always done that."
"In what particular form now?"
"In the form of a flight from mid-Atlantic to Colorado in a plane loaded with gold beyond the safety point of its capacity. Wait till Midas sees the amount I have to deposit. My customers this year will become richer by—
Say, have you told Miss Taggart that she's one of my customers?"
"No, not yet."
"You may tell her if you wish."
"I'm— What did you say I am?" she asked.
"Don't be shocked, Miss Taggart," said Donnershuld. "And don't object. I'm used to objections. I'm a sort of freak here anyway. None of them approve of my particular method of fighting our battle. John doesn't, Dr. Axton doesn't. They think that my life is too valuable for it. But, you see, my father was a bishop, and of all his teachings there was only one sentence that I accepted. All they that take the sword shall perish with the sword."
"What do you mean?"
"That violence is not practical. If my fellow men believe that the force of the combined tonnage of their muscles is a practical means to rule me, let them learn the outcome of a contest in which there's nothing but brute force on one side, and force ruled by a mind on the other. Even John grants me that in our age I had the moral right to choose the course I've chosen. I'm doing just what he is doing, only in my own way. He is withdrawing man's spirit from the looters. I'm withdrawing the products of man's spirit. He is depriving them of reason, I'm depriving them of wealth. He is draining the soul of the world. I'm draining its body. His is the lesson they have to learn, only I'm impatient, and I'm hastening their scholastic progress. But like John, I'm simply complying with their moral code and refusing to grant them a double standard at my expense, or at Reardon's expense, or at yours. What are you talking about? About a method of taxing the income taxers. All methods of taxation are complex, but this one is very simple because it's the naked essence of all the others. Let me explain it to you. She listened. She heard a sparkling voice reciting, in the tone of a dryly meticulous bookkeeper, a report about financial transfers, bank accounts, income tax returns, as if he were reading the dusty pages of a ledger where every entry was made by means of offering his own blood as the collateral to be drained at any moment, at any slip of his bookkeeping pen. As she listened, she kept seeing the perfection of his face, and she kept thinking that this was the head on which the world had placed a price of millions for the purpose of delivering it to the rot of death. The face she had thought too beautiful for the scars of a productive career, she kept thinking numbly, missing half his words, the face too beautiful to risk. Then it struck her that his physical perfection was only a simple illustration, a childish lesson given to her in crudely obvious terms on the nature of the outer world and on the fate of any human value in a subhuman age. Whatever the justice or the evil of his course, she thought, how could they? No, she thought, his course was just, and this was the horror of it, that there was no other course for justice to select, that she could not condemn him, that she could neither approve nor utter a word of reproach. And the names of my customers, Miss Taggart, were chosen slowly, one by one. I had to be certain of the nature of their character and career. On my list of restitution, your name was one of the first. She forced herself to keep her face expressionlessly tight, and she answered only, I see. Your account is one of the last left unpaid. It is here at the Mulligan Bank to be claimed by you on the day when you join us. I see. Your account, however, is not as large as some of the others, even though huge sums were extorted from you by force in the past 12 years. You will find, as it is marked on the copies of your income tax returns, which Mulligan will hand over to you, that I have refunded only those taxes which you paid on the salary you earned as operating vice president, but not the taxes you paid on your income from your Taggart Transcontinental stock. You deserved every penny of that stock, and in the days of your father I would have refunded every penny of your profit. But under your brother's management, Taggart Transcontinental has taken its share of the looting. It has made profits by force, by means of government favors, subsidies, moratoriums, directives. You were not responsible for it. You were, in fact, the greatest victim of that policy. But I refunded only the money which was made by pure productive ability, not the money, any part of which was loot, taken by force. I see. They had finished their breakfast. Donnishold lighted a cigarette and watched her for an instant through the first jet of smoke, as if he knew the violence of the conflict in her mind. Then he grinned at Galt and rose to his feet. "I'll run along," he said. "My wife is waiting for me." "What?" she gasped. "My wife," he repeated gaily, as if he had not understood the reason of her shock. "Who is your wife?" "Kay Ludlow." The implications that struck her were more than she could bear to consider. When were you married?
4 years ago.
How could you show yourself anywhere long enough to go through a wedding ceremony?
We were married here by Judge Narragansett.
She tried to stop, but the words burst involuntarily, in helpless, indignant protest, whether against him, fate, or the outer world, she could not tell. How can she live through 11 months of thinking that you at any moment might be? She did not finish. He was smiling, but she saw the enormous solemnity of that which he and his wife had needed to earn their right to this kind of smile.
She can live through it, Miss Taggart, because we do not hold the belief that this earth is a realm of misery where man is doomed to destruction. We do not think that tragedy is our natural fate, and we do not live in chronic dread of disaster. We do not expect disaster until we have specific reason to expect it, and when we encounter it, we are free to fight it. It is not happiness, but suffering, that we consider unnatural.
It is not success, but calamity that we regard as the abnormal exception in human life."
Galt accompanied him to the door, then came back, sat down at the table, and in a leisurely manner reached for another cup of coffee. She shot to her feet as if flung by a jet of pressure, breaking a safety valve. "Do you think that I'll ever accept his money?" He waited until the curving streak of coffee had filled his cup, then glanced up at her and answered, "Yes, I think so."
"Well, I won't. I won't let him risk his life for it."
"You have no choice about that."
"I have the choice never to claim it."
"Yes, you have." "Then it will lie in that bank till doomsday." "No, it won't. If you don't claim it, some part of it, a very small part, will be turned over to me in your name."
"In my name? Why?"
"To pay for your room and board."
She stared at him, her look of anger switching to bewilderment, then dropped slowly back on her chair.
He smiled. "How long did you think you were going to stay here, Miss Taggart?" He saw her startled look of helplessness. "You haven't thought of it?"
"I have."
"You're going to stay here for a month, for the 1 month of our vacation, like the rest of us. I'm not asking for your consent. You did not ask for ours when you came here. You broke our rules, so you'll have to take the consequences. Nobody leaves the valley during this month. I could let you go, of course, but I won't. There's no rule demanding that I hold you, but by forcing your way here, you've given me the right to any choice I make. And I'm going to hold you simply because I want you here. If at the end of a month you decide that you wish to go back, you will be free to do so. Not until then."
She sat straight, the planes of her face relaxed, the shape of her mouth softened by the faint, purposeful suggestion of a smile. It was the dangerous smile of an adversary, but her eyes were coldly brilliant and veiled at once, like the eyes of an adversary who fully intends to fight, but hopes to lose.
"Very well," she said.
"I shall charge you for your room and board. It is against our rules to provide the unearned sustenance of another human being. Some of us have wives and children, but there's a mutual trade involved in that, and a mutual payment."
He glanced at her.
"Of a kind I am not entitled to collect. So I shall charge you 50 cents a day, and you will pay me when you accept the amount that lies in your name at the Mulligan Bank. If you don't accept the account, Mulligan will charge your debt against it, and he will give me the money when I ask for it."
"I shall comply with your terms," she answered.
Her voice had the shrewd, confident, deliberating slowness of a trader. "But I shall not permit the use of that money for my debts."
"How else do you propose to comply?"
"I propose to earn my room and board."
"By what means?"
"By working."
"In what capacity?"
"In the capacity of your cook and housemaid." For the first time, she saw him take the shock of the unexpected, in a manner and with a violence she had not foreseen. It was only an explosion of laughter on his part, but he laughed as if he were hit beyond his defenses, much beyond the immediate meaning of her words. She felt that she had struck his past, tearing loose some memory and meaning of his own which she could not know. He laughed as if he were seeing some distant image, as if he were laughing in its face, as if this were his victory, and hers. "If you will hire me," she said, her face severely polite, her tone harshly clear, impersonal, and businesslike, "I shall cook your meals, clean your house, do your laundry, and perform such other duties as are required of a servant, in exchange for my room, board, and such money as I will need for some items of clothing. I may be slightly handicapped by my injuries for the next few days, but that will not last, and I will be able to do the job fully."
"Is that what you want to do?" he asked.
"That is what I want to do," she answered, and stopped before she uttered the rest of the answer in her mind. "More than anything else in the world." He was still smiling. It was a smile of amusement. But it was as if amusement could be transmuted into some shining glory.
"All right, Miss Taggart," he said. "I'll hire you." She inclined her head in a dryly formal acknowledgment.
"Thank you."
"I will pay you $10 a month, in addition to your room and board."
"Very well."
"I shall be the first man in this valley to hire a servant."
He got up, reached into his pocket, and threw a $5 gold piece down on the table.
"As advance on your wages," he said. She was startled to discover, as her hand reached for the gold piece,
that she felt the eager, desperate, tremulous hope of a young girl on her first job, the hope that she would be able to deserve it. "Yes, sir," she said, her eyes lowered. Owen Kellogg arrived on the afternoon of her third day in the valley. She did not know which shocked him most. The sight of her standing on the edge of the airfield as he descended from the plane, the sight of her clothes, her delicate transparent blouse tailored by the most expensive shop in New York, and the wide cotton print skirt she had bought in the valley for 60 cents, her cane, her bandages, or the basket of groceries on her arm. He descended among a group of men. He saw her. He stopped, then ran to her, as if flung forward by some emotion so strong that, whatever its nature, it looked like terror. "Miss Taggart," he whispered, and said nothing else, while she laughed, trying to explain how she had come to beat him to his destination. He listened as if it were irrelevant, and then he uttered the thing from which he had to recover. "But we thought you were dead." "Who thought it?" "All of us. I mean, everybody in the outside world." Then she suddenly stopped smiling, while his voice began to recapture his story and his first sound of joy. "Miss Taggart, don't you remember? You told me to phone Winston, Colorado, and to tell them that you'd be there by noon of the next day. That was to be the day before yesterday, May 31st. But you did not reach Winston, and by late afternoon the news was on all the radios that you were lost in a plane crash somewhere in the Rocky Mountains." She nodded slowly, grasping the events she had not thought of considering. "I heard it aboard the Comet," he said, "at a small station in the middle of New Mexico. The conductor held us there for an hour while I helped him to check the story on long-distance phones. He was hit by the news just as I was. They all were, the train crew, the station agent, the switchmen. They huddled around me while I called the city rooms of newspapers in Denver and New York. We didn't learn much, only that you had left the Afton airfield just before dawn on May 31st, that you seemed to be following some stranger's plane, that the attendant had seen you go off southeast, and that nobody had seen you since, and that searching parties were combing the Rockies for the wreckage of your plane." She asked involuntarily, "Did the Comet reach San Francisco?" "I don't know. She was crawling north through Arizona when I gave up. There were too many delays, too many things going wrong, and a total confusion of orders. I got off and spent the night hitchhiking my way to Colorado, bumming rides on trucks, on buggies, on horse carts, to get there on time. To get to our meeting place, I mean, where we gather for Midas's ferry plane to pick us up and bring us here." She started walking slowly up the path toward the car she had left in front of Hammond's grocery market. Kellogg followed, and when he spoke again, his voice dropped a little, slowing down with their steps, as if there were something they both wished to delay. "I got a job for Jeff Allen," he said. His voice had the peculiarly solemn tone proper for saying, "I have carried out your last will." "Your agent at Laurel grabbed him and put him to work the moment we got there. The agent needed every able-minded man he could find." They had reached the car, but she did not get in. "Miss Taggart, you weren't hurt badly, were you? Did you say you crashed, but it wasn't serious?" "No, not serious at all. I'll be able to get along without Mr. Mulligan's car by tomorrow. And in a day or two I won't need this thing either." She swung her cane and tossed it contemptuously into the car. They stood in silence. She was waiting. "The last long-distance call I made from that station in New Mexico," he said slowly, "was to Pennsylvania. I spoke to Hank Reardon. I told him everything I knew. He listened, and then there was a pause, and then he said, 'Thank you for calling me.'" Kellogg's eyes were lowered. He added, "I never want to hear that kind of pause again as long as I live." He raised his eyes to hers. There was no reproach in his glance, only the knowledge of that which he had not suspected when he heard her request, but had guessed since. "Thank you,"